听力课堂，听 class.com。
全国翻译专业资格水平考试辅导丛书，英语口译综合能力三级，第七和。
Unit 13 B
Part 1 A Internet advertising has rebounded from the dog days of the dot-com bust and is on track this year to eclipse the record $8.1 billion in revenues it took in 4 years ago. The Internet finally appears to be living up to its promise of becoming a viable advertising medium.Although advertising on websites remains but a tiny fraction of the overall U.S. advertising market, it is one of the fastest growing segments. Experts say the web share of total ad dollars will continue to rise as the Internet becomes more ubiquitous and the media marketplace more fragmented. Internet sites have benefited from improved technology and an increasing number of people who have high-speed online connections.And of course, there's the Google factor. The Mountain View search engine company booked nearly $1 billion in revenue last year. In the most recent quarter, 96% of Google's revenue came from ads, establishing search as the hottest category of internet advertising around. Overall, internet advertising reached $7.3 billion in 2003, up 21% over 2002,According to the Interactive Advertising Bureau. eMarketer, a New York research company, anticipates continued double-digit growth at 15.6% to $8.4 billion this year and 17.9% to $9.9 billion in 2005. That outstrips the 5 to 7% growth for advertising in general that industry watchers predict.Internet ad spending accounted for about 3% of total U.S. ad spending in 2003, the Bureau reported, up from 2.5%.
B. 1. In order for you to follow the schedule set by the publisher, your paper must be looked over the weekend, revised, and handed in its final form on Monday. 2. In sport,It's usually men who grab the headlines. 3. Advertisers use media to convey commercial messages to their target audiences, and the media depend to different degrees on advertising revenues to cover the cost of their operations. 4. The audience size is the currency of advertising media. 5.A strategic decision is how to allocate the media budget geographically, that is, deciding in which markets to advertise and how much to spend in each of these markets. 6. Advertising media, such as cable television and direct mail, are often viewed as niche media because they reach a narrowly defined audience with unique demographic characteristics or special interests.7. Media plans are implemented through media buyers. 8. The newspaper reported that Liverpool and England are neck and neck in strength. 9. In a newspaper article, he came down on his boss, hammer and tongs. 10. Miniskirts caught on in the 1960s because of the advertising.
Part 2. Coca-Cola has bucked the trend for celebrity-fronted advertising by choosing a virtually unknown British artist to front one of its biggest UK campaigns. While arch-rival Pepsi features the likes of David Beckham and Beyoncé Knowles in its campaigns, Coca-Cola has hired the Basement Jaxx vocalist Charlene Hector to star in its first-ever UK branding campaign for Coca-Cola Classic.The advert breaks tomorrow and features Hector singing the Nina Simone classic I Wish as she walks through the streets distributing bottles of Coca-Cola. It is the latest in the company's new Real campaign, which took over from the Always Coca-Cola adverts and is aimed at giving the brand a more irreverent image. The actress Penelope Cruz has appeared belching after drinking Coke in adverts in the U.S. The new advertising is the first campaign to be created by the quirky British advertising agency Mother, which won the Coca-Cola business last year after pitching against the company's pitching U.S. agency, McCann Erickson. The agency had already created a campaign for Coca-Cola-owned Lilt, Oasis, and Schweppes, and was charged with coming up with a specifically British approach to the world's best-known brand. The strategy is part of the Coca-Cola chairman and chief executive Douglas Daft's so-called Think Local, Act Local philosophy. Inspired by the realization that what works for American philosophy will not necessarily succeed elsewhere.
Part 3, Passage 1. Both product and institutional advertising can be subdivided into three categories according to purpose: to inform, persuade, or remind. Informative advertising, intended to build initial demand for a product, is sued in the introductory phase of the product life cycle. When Johnson & Johnson introduced its AccuView disposable contact lens, the nation's first disposable lens, it launched a massive advertising campaign directed at consumers and eye care professionals to explain the health benefits of using the new product. Persuasive advertising attempts to improve the competitive status of a product, institution, or concept. It is used in the growth and maturity stages of the product life cycle. In Europe, for example, cereal companies like General Mills and Kellogg's are trying to persuade more consumers to eat cereal for breakfast, and because of their ads, cereal consumption in some European countries has risen by 30%. One of the most popular types of persuasive product advertising is comparative advertising, which compares products directly to their competitors. One familiar example is Pepsi, which has used its Pepsi Challenge ads, involving blind taste tests, to battle Coke. Now PepsiCo is taking comparative advertising to Japan, which has traditionally avoided this kind of advertising. Japan feels such advertising rude and confrontational. You should never see Nissan do such a thing against Toyota, or vice versa, says a professor of advertising at Tokyo Keizai University. Pepsi's Japanese ads may be a first step towards bringing American-influenced comparative advertising to that country. Reminder-oriented advertising, often used in the late maturity or decline stages of the product life cycle, tries to remind people of the importance and usefulness of a product, concept, or institution. Police cars in many areas of the U.S. carry reminder-oriented themes such as "We Protect and Serve." In an era of traffic jams and rising gas prices, GTE reminds consumers of how efficient the humble telephone can be. Its ads, showing a streamlined phone with automotive taillights and fins, announce, "For getting around town, nothing outperforms your phone."
Passage 2. The largest category in your advertising budget is likely to be your media costs, the dollars you spend for airtime on radio, or for ad space in newspapers, magazines, and more. Because of this, it makes sense to have a sound plan to manage that investment. You'll want to set goals. You'll want to describe strategies for achieving them. You'll have to organize the day-to-day tasks of carrying out the strategies. The tool you'll need to do this is a media plan that begins with an overview and works its way down to the details. It will help you with every phase of your advertising. Here's how many businesses manage their media buying. The person in charge of the budget starts saying yes to the salespeople who call. advertising appears here and there as a result. When the budget's gone, the person in charge starts saying no, and the ad campaign is over. It's a method, but you wouldn't call it a media plan. And if that approach sounds familiar, you can bet you're passing up opportunities to maximize your return on investment. Media planning is the process of choosing a course of action. Media planners develop yearly plans that list each media outlet, print or broadcast. Planning then gives way to buying, as each separate contract is negotiated, then finalized. The media plan is a document in sections. A ring binder notebook is a good way to keep a media plan because it's easy to update and easy to refer to. Or if you prefer to work on a computer, simply think in terms of folders and files. The sections in your notebook include media outlets, goals, audience, strategy, and budget and calendar. The document you compiled in this notebook guides you in the execution of the plan throughout the year.
Passage 3. Now I'd like to talk about some basic media concepts you are supposed to understand. The term you'll hear most often is CPM, or cost per thousand. It represents the cost of reaching 1,000 people via different types of media. By finding this information and calculating this cost for each of your options, you can give them a numerical ranking for comparison. Print advertising prices are based on the circulation of the publication in question. Publications will quote you a circulation figure based on paid subscribers. The audited circulation figures are verified by monitoring organizations. The publications will try to convince you that actual circulation is higher by including the free copies they distribute and the pass-along readership they claim. Sometimes these claims of bonus circulation are valid. Audience is the equivalent of circulation when you're talking about broadcast media. Audience size varies throughout the day as people tune in and tune out. Therefore, the price for advertising at different times of day will vary based on the audience size that the day part delivers. Penetration is related to circulation. It describes how much of the total market available you are reaching. If you are in a town with 200,000 households and you buy an ad in a coupon book that states a circulation of 140,000, you're reaching 70% of the possible market. High penetration. What degree of penetration is necessary for you depends on whether your strategy is to dominate the market or to reach a certain niche within that market. Reach and frequency are key media terms used more in broadcast than in print. Reach is the total number of people exposed to a message at least once in a set time period, usually 4 weeks, while frequency is the average number of times those people are exposed during that time period. Usually, when reach goes up, you have to compromise and let frequency go down. To achieve a high reach and a high frequency, you must balance reach, frequency, and budget constraints in order to find the best combination in view of your marketing goals. Part 4. Firms in the advertising and public relations services industry prepare advertisements for other companies and organizations and design campaigns to promote the interests and image of their clients. This industry also includes media representatives, firms that sell advertising space for publications, radio, television, and the internet, display advertisers, businesses engaged in creating and designing public display ads for use in shopping malls, on billboards, or in similar media, and direct mail advertisers. A firm that purchases advertising time or space from media outlets, thereafter reselling it to advertising agencies or individual companies directly, is considered a media buying agency. divisions of companies that produce and place their own advertising are not considered part of this industry. There are 47,000 advertising and public relations services establishments in the United States. About 4 out of 10 write copy and prepare artwork, graphics, and other creative work, and then place the resulting ads on television, radio, or the internet, or in periodicals, newspapers, or other advertising media. Within the industry, only these full-service establishments are known as advertising agencies. Almost 1 in 5 are public relations firms. Many of the largest agencies are international, with a substantial proportion of their revenue coming from abroad. Most advertising firms specialize in a particular market niche. Some companies produce and solicit outdoor advertising, such as billboards and electric displays. Others place ads in buses, subways, taxis, airports, and bus terminals. A small number of firms produce aerial advertising, while others distribute circulars, handbills, and free samples. Groups within agencies have been created to serve their clients' electronic advertising needs on the Internet. Online advertisements link users from one website to a company's or product's website, where information such as new product announcements, contests, and product catalogs appears, and from which purchases may be made. Some firms are not involved in the creation of ads at all. Instead, they sell advertising time or space on radio and television stations or in publications. Because these firms do not produce advertising, their staffs are mostly sales workers. Companies often look to advertising as a way of boosting sales by increasing the public's exposure to a product. Most companies do not have the staff with the necessary skills or experience to create effective advertisements. Furthermore, many advertising campaigns are temporary, so employers would have difficulty maintaining their own advertising staff. Instead, companies commonly solicit bids from ad agencies to develop advertising for them. Next, ad agencies offering their services to the company often make presentations. The real work for ad agencies begins when they win an account. Various departments within an agency, such as creative, production, media, and research, work together to meet the client's goal of increasing sales. Widespread public relations services firms influence how businesses, governments, and institutions make decisions, and in so doing, affect the lives of all Americans. Often working behind the scenes, these firms have a variety of functions. In general, firms in public relations services advise and implement public exposure strategies. For example, a public relations firm might issue a press release that is printed in newspapers across the country. Firms in public relations services offer one or more resources that clients cannot provide themselves. Usually this resource is expertise, in the form of knowledge, experience, special skills, or creativity, but sometimes the resource is time or personnel that the client cannot spare. Clients of public relations firms include all types of businesses, institutions, trades, and public interest groups, and even some high-profile individuals. Clients are large and small for-profit firms in the private sector, bodies of state, local, or federal government, institutions such as hospitals, universities, unions, and trade groups, and foreign governments or businesses. Public relations firms help secure favorable public exposure for their clients, advise them in the case of a sudden public crisis, and design strategies to help them attain a certain public image. Toward these ends, public relations firms analyze public or internal sentiment about clients, establish relationships with the media, write speeches and coach clients for interviews, issue press releases, and organize client-sponsored publicity events, such as contests, concerts, exhibits, symposia, and sporting and charity events. Lobbying firms, a special type of public relations firm, differ somewhat. Instead of attempting to secure favorable public opinion about their clients, they attempt to influence legislators in favor of their clients' special interests. Lobbyists often work for large businesses, industry trade organizations, unions, or public interest groups. Unit 14, A.
Part 1, A. A very important world problem facing us today is the rapidly increasing pressure of population on the land. Suppose we first take a look at the map of the world. If we go back to only about 200 years ago, there were large parts of the world that had not then been explored. For example, Australia was unknown. The vast west of Canada and the United States had not been opened up, and the heart of Africa was just marked as unexplored. The position at the present day is absolutely different. We now know roughly the actual extent of the Earth's surface. Even the outline of the Antarctic continent is shown in a solid line on the latest maps. We have settled down to the idea that the Earth's land surface is something fixed and will not extend anymore. But what about population? The population of the world today is about 6 billion. That is an enormous number. The important thing is not so much the actual population of the world, but its rate of increase. It works out to be about 1.6% annual net increase. In numbers, this means something like 40 to 45 million additional people every year. Canada has a population of 20 million, rather less than 6 months increase in world population. Take England and Wales, 45 to 50 million people. This is just about a year's supply. In many parts of the world, we are degrading the carrying capacity of the environment to support the enormous population, and the environment is unable to sustain human activities long if actions are not taken to cope with the problem.
B. 1. Then, why population growth reached all-time high levels in the late 20th century? 2. At age 23, smoking rates among blacks and Asian Americans remained much lower than for whites. 3. Net migration is the number of immigrants minus emigrants. 4. The term natural decrease refers to population decline resulting from more deaths than births. 5. With health improvements, death rates fall much more rapidly in the developing countries. 6. Americans are taken hostage or executed for being in a hostile country at the wrong place at the wrong time. 7. Perhaps we, as a people, have become overconfident that nothing is going to happen to us, so we take unnecessary risks. 8. In 1961, John Kennedy was sworn in as President of the United States. 9. Helen supported her children by teaching school, yet she got more enjoyment from reading and writing poetry. 10. Readers liked the way Frost took simple material and constructed from it a world of new meanings.
Part 2. That a country has a huge land area and a relatively small population does not mean it can continue to grow unchecked. In Canada and Australia, for instance, activists are raising the possibility that they may already be overpopulated. Australians are worried about two wildly different negative scenarios. In one, unchecked development and consumption ruin the country's habitat, native species, and quality of life. In the other, Australia's economy comes to a halt as the populace ages and babies become heavy burdens. Both pictures suggest a population crisis begging to be resolved. With 19.8 million people in an area roughly the size of 3 million square miles, Australia may seem very underpopulated. But much of Australia's land is arid and uninhabitable, subject to frequent floods and droughts. Nearly all Australians are packed into two coastal strips, around Perth and near Sydney and Melbourne. Sustainable Population Australia, SPA, an organization that calls for an environmentally responsible population policy, contends that Australia's environment cannot sustain any more growth. It argues that development is eating up the land, dirtying the water, and taking vital habitat from wild animals and plants. But if the population grows to 25 million or 40 million in the next 50 years, as several projections suggest, the effects would be disastrous, says Jenny Goldie, SPA's national director.
Part 3, Passage 1. The immigration of Vietnamese to the United States is a relatively new process. It started right after the Vietnam War ended in 1975 and continues today. The first wave of immigration to America saw 130,000 people who came after the collapse of the Thieu regime in 1975. They fled because they were unsure about the future of their country and because they wanted a better life for their children. Between 1978 and 1981, over a million Vietnamese left their country on boats. Not all of these people went to the U.S. because it was both very far and very dangerous. In order to get out of Vietnam, many had to bribe officials with gold. This left many of them with no money at all to help start a new life when they arrived in America. These boat journeys were very dangerous, and it was estimated that roughly a third of all those who fled by sea died. The reasons for this large proportion of deaths were attributed to Thai sea pirates, violent storms, and shortages of food, water, and fuel supplies. After the first wave of immigrants, the percent of Vietnamese Americans grew 142%. Currently, 80% of Vietnamese Americans are foreign-born. This percentage explains why the Vietnamese culture is still very prominent and important in present Vietnamese families and communities. This is primarily due to the simple fact that the Vietnamese haven't been in the U.S. long, and thus are lower down on the assimilation ladder discussed in the straight line theory.
Passage 2. Wedged between the world's two population billionaires, China and India, Nepal is struggling with its own population pressures. The country has 23 million people, and most of them make their living from farming. They have nearly run out of land to cultivate, while their numbers continue to grow. Poverty, the highest outside of Africa, persists, and internal conflict is draining already scarce natural resources. Nepal's 10th population census was conducted in June 2001. It produced a population count of 23,214,681. That number marked an increase of 5 million since the previous census in 1991, and an average annual growth rate of 2.3%. According to the census, 86% of this growing population lives in rural areas, and 82% of the economically active population works in agriculture, fishing, or forestry. Because one-third of the country consists of mountains or hills, little additional land is available to tend. The share of land being cultivated rose from 17% in 1974 to 30% in 1998, and the remaining areas that could be added consist mostly of slopes and marginal lands that are environmentally sensitive and less productive.
Passage 3. Today, we begin the story of 20th century poet Robert Frost. Robert Frost was one of America's best known and most honored serious writers, but his fame came late in his life. He was 40 years old before Americans began to read his poems and praise them. Once his fame was established, however, it grew stronger and stronger during the rest of his long life. His success came from uniting traditional forms of poetry with American words. Readers liked the way he spoke with a voice that sounded like common speech. They liked the way he took simple material and constructed from it a world of new meanings. Someone once asked another American writer, Ernest Hemingway, how to become a writer. The best thing, he said, was to have an unhappy childhood. If this is true, Robert Frost's childhood was unhappy enough to make him a very good writer. At one time, he worked in a factory. Later, he repaired shoes. He was a teacher, a reporter, and a farmer. Always, he wrote poetry, but until 1913, he earned only about $10 a year from writing. His family was always poor. In 1912, Frost took his family to Britain. There he published his first book of poems, A Boy's Will, and received high praise from British readers. With the help of Ezra Pound, he published his second book of poems, North of Boston, in America. When he returned to America in 1915, he was surprised by the praise he received and the acceptance of American publishers. Success did not ease his life. The gentle, wise person who spoke from his poems was the man Frost wanted to be. He knew, however, and his family knew, he was not that man. As he grew older, his world was more touched with sadness. He wrote more about fear, about being alone, about losing whatever he had. Part 4. Each person has his own culture and norms, and those habits are his way of life. Sometimes these values can come into conflict with other cultures when a person travels in a foreign country. The difficulty that some people have adjusting to a new culture is called culture shock. Culture shock is your mind and body's reaction to being confused and feeling overwhelmed in unfamiliar surroundings. It can cause both psychological discomfort, such as irritability, anger over minor frustrations, confusion about morals and values, and physical discomfort, like headaches, lethargy, sleep problems, loss of appetite, and digestive irregularities. Suffering from culture shock often leaves people feeling moody, isolated, and insecure. There are several stages that human beings pass through when they enter and live in a new culture. Not everyone experiences the exact stages, but most travelers will go through the highs and lows. Culture shock begins with the honeymoon stage. This is the period when you first arrive in a new place where everything about the new culture is strange and exciting. You may be suffering from jet lag, but you are thrilled to be in the new environment, seeing new sights, hearing new sounds and language, eating new kinds of food. This honeymoon stage may last from a few days or weeks to 6 months when you feel involved in some kind of great adventure. Unfortunately, the second stage of culture shock can be more difficult. After you have settled down into your new life, working or studying, buying groceries, or doing laundry, you find that all the little problems in life seem to be much bigger and more disturbing in a foreign culture. Cultural differences in behavior and values become more obvious, too. What previously seemed exciting, new, and challenging is now merely frustrating. You begin to miss your homeland and seek security in the familiar. You may reject or pull away from the new culture. This rejection stage can be dangerous because you may develop unhealthy habits like smoking and drinking too much. This stage is considered a crisis in the process of cultural adjustment, and many people choose to go back to their homeland or spend all their time with people from their own culture speaking their native language. The third stage of culture shock is called the adjustment stage. This is when you begin to realize that things are not so bad in the host culture. Based on your successes in negotiating a variety of social situations and maybe increased language skills, your self-esteem grows, and you realize that you are becoming stronger by learning to take care of yourself in the new place. Things are still difficult, but you are now a survivor. The fourth stage can be called at ease at last. Now you feel quite comfortable in your new surroundings. You may still have problems with the language, but you know you are strong enough to deal with them. If you meet someone from your country who has just arrived, you can be the expert on life in the new culture and help them to deal with their culture shock. There is a fifth stage of culture shock that many people don't know about. This is called the reverse culture shock. Surprisingly, this occurs when you go back to your native culture and find that you have changed and that things there have changed while you have been away. Now you feel a little uncomfortable back home. Life is a struggle.